Let's take our next presentation, which will be conducted by the South African Institute of Professional Accountants. I'm not giving names yet, but according to the Big Book, their team is comprised of Mr. Ratif. Yeah, Mr. Ratif is the chairperson of the Plan Committee. Will do the presentation to us. Thank you. We'll keep it quite brief. We did make a submission on various items. We made two separate submissions because there were two different draft bills to consider. We will only be looking at the taxation rules amendment. And instead of trying to labour, we know that our colleagues was addressing various issues, as you heard earlier, in great detail. So what we've done is we have focused more on our member base and their type of client, which would typically be the small to medium-sized businesses. And there are three basic issues that we'd like to address today. The first would be with regards to equity shares. Now, as a starting point, we are not opposed to the concept of addressing the difference between debt versus equity, and that is something that obviously is a theme that will carry forward for the next few years in tax evasion and closing the loopholes and addressing tax policy correctly. Well, however, we did identify, obviously there is the correlation between the Old Companies Act and the New Companies Act and the way we carry forward certain definitions, and in doing so, one of the definitions regarding equity shares, what it does at the moment is we believe that there is an unintended consequences when we apply it in terms of Section 45, that what it will be typically be in type transactions where there will be redeemable preference shares associated with it. What will happen is those have fixed dividend rates as well to the BEE partners, and what will happen is these will create a situation of where essentially these entities would have to be regrouping or regroup in order to facilitate the transaction in terms of the current draft amendments. So our recommendation is that it is far too wide the net being cast at the moment to just, and if you looked at the submissions made earlier by PwC, and that, on the same theme as we're saying is that we have a concept of what we're trying to address and a certain avoidance that we're trying to shut down and a policy we want to enforce. The net being cast so wide and the specific facts not all being considered in a specific provision, it does have unintended consequences, and we believe it could impact on companies where there is already structured BEE deals in place, specifically with redeemable preference shares. The second issue, which of course follows the theme of our constituency, which is more based around the small medium enterprises, and we've before made submission to this very committee that things such as the small business corporation provisions are still very restrictive, and that tax policy can have a significant impact on how it addresses the growth and the prosperity of small medium businesses. Now, we're quite happy that there was for hybrid recategorization rules, there was a provision allowed in there, a ceiling of 10 million rand in terms of growth assets to assist that, and essentially this is to classify whether something should be treated as an in-specie dividend or whether there's an interest component that could be treated for tax that way. The problem that we see with this though is that this is a very hard ceiling of saying 10 million gross assets, and very little regard is given to essentially the different natures of business that you'd encounter. So something like a service provider, a 10 million gross asset base is enormous from a small business point of view, where if you're dealing with retail or manufacturing, then 10 million gross assets is not exactly a very difficult task or target to hit. So our proposal here is that we should have a better understanding of what a small medium enterprise is, because we're finding that there is various provisions related to small business enterprises, and they all seem to have their own idea of what it is. There seems to be no coherent threshold to determine this. Now, this provision specifically, we're asking that there needs to be a revision of that 10 million. Not that we're unhappy with the value of 10 million, but we just believe that 10 million is unfortunately, it's a bit of one size fits all, and unfortunately not all businesses have that situation. Now, unfortunately, the 10 million might be too restrictive, especially if we want to look at job creation, because in your manufacturing and those kind of sectors, there is greater opportunities for lower income and entry-level work, as well as skills development, and 10 million gross assets is just poor. It's a very easy target to hit, and then you basically are limited in what deductions you're allowed for interest purposes. The last one that we're wanting to address relates to the Value Add Tax Act. Now, if I can for a moment just mention that some of the fundamental principles of that makes it work is not only the ability to register and to administer the vendor, but the flow of documentation that supports every transaction. And it's for that very reason why Section 20 of the VAT Act clearly specifies that within 21 days of a transaction taking place, a supply, that a tax invoice has to be produced with specific requirements to it. And all those requirements that are on there, such as the party's VAT number, their address, the detail, a description of the services or goods being provided, all of these are fundamental in two things. One, to support what the transaction is, the nature of transaction, so that you can correctly treat it for input claims, as well as whether or not the correct output tax was charged. And it also is an evidentiary situation for audit purposes. Now, one of the problems with the current legislation is that if I issue a tax invoice and the tax invoice is incorrect, so let's say I forget to put, well, I did not have the VAT number of the person who I'm making supply to, I do not have their VAT number, I failed to put it on there. The problem is that this tax invoice is now not supportive of an input tax claim on the other side. So currently, what you have to do is the person who issued the invoice would have to make an amendment to it. Now, again, here's a very manual process of making an amendment. And if the description is wrong, you know, you have this invoice with this handwritten amendments to it. It's a very, very untidy way of doing it. So we're quite supportive of this recommendation or this proposal of allowing that a debit or credit note could be issued to remedy the faulty invoice in the first place. But what we have a problem with is that the proposal that is currently in the bill is very wide. It basically allows for you to make amendment of the entire invoice without it even being a tax invoice to start with, because it allows for you to literally fix anything that you failed to comply with in terms of Section 20. Now, that includes that I failed to put an individual serialized number to an invoice, I failed to call it a tax invoice, failed to put that vendor's numbers on it, description, all of these. But from the beginning, I issue a document and I don't call it a tax invoice. I don't have it in my formal system with an invoice number to it that's serialized, that can be audited, that can be tracked from a fraud point of view being addressed. But I now allow another document for me to fix the original document. Now, it's one thing for the document to be flawed, so the description is wrong, or your VAT number I failed to put in there. Another thing is to not have a tax invoice to start off with in the first place. So our recommendations is that it should be limited, and we did make the recommendation that if you look at the last slide, at the specific provisions, it should be limited. So it should be limited to the sub-provision D and E. So essentially, it allows for you to make any alteration to description of goods. Already, a debit or credit note would be used for changing the consideration value attached to that. And, of course, things such as the failure of putting a VAT vendor's number to it could be done. But the principle of the minimum of that it says tax invoice, that I have an individual serialized number on it, and that me, the person who issued it, that I put my VAT number on it because I'm charging you VAT. That at least should be there for it to be a tax invoice as per Section 20. Because otherwise what we're doing is we're now allowing for secondary documents to substitute the requirement of the primary document, which is essential for auditing, essential for identifying your obligation for VAT. It's a trigger of that VAT obligation as well, and also it's a supporting document for claiming your input tax deductions on the other side. So our proposal is to limit what amendments can be done in terms of debit credit note. So the starting point always should be, it must be a tax invoice meeting some basic minimum requirements issued in terms of Section 20 before I can correct. I can't fix something that doesn't exist. So there first has to be a tax invoice before I can fix it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for saying for your concise presentation. And I think it helps in terms of managing time on our side. So we are going to take our next presentation, and thereafter I will take discussions. So our next presentation will be done by the South African Institute of Tax Practitioners, which according to my note here is represented by Mr. Plume as well as Mr. Herring and Mr. Nechibungululo. This is your chair. You are welcome.
Good morning, Paul Gehring for the South African Institute of Tax Practitioners. An honor to be here. My father presented 12 years ago before Barbara Hogan on the Bills of Exchange Act. So it's 12 years and another year in kind of before this committee. Whilst this has been hammered home a little bit by PwC, I think it's still important if we go back to ancient Rome, Gallia and Tres Partes Divisa Est, every time it was said and said again, until finally it was hammered home. If we are going to have a consultation process, we must do that consultation process properly and with meaning. Everyone needs time to do it. We don't want to come back again and again for amendments to acts even before they are implemented. I think that that is an important thing. It's also important to note that this hearing is covering one of the bills, but there are two bills that are in circulation. Some of the comments have come through from those other bills, but it would have been better if this was formally dealing with both of those bills in a proper manner, especially as they are going through Parliament relatively quickly. As such, we've taken a policy decision not to be a lobby group, but to deal with things that we believe are going to have a general impact on the economy or the profession or society. And so we have tried to keep our comments limited to this regard.
Thank you. I will be addressing the issue with regard to the concessions of medical expenses to medical tax credit. We are in principle not opposed to the conversion from the current regime to the tax credit. However, we feel that the equity is being missed through implications, more especially as it applies to the disadvantaged by age or the disadvantaged probably by the condition of being physically challenged. As far as that is concerned, we are concerned that the proposals as they are will have a negative effect on taxpayers who are 65 years and older. It will also have a negative effect on taxpayers who are physically challenged, as I have already mentioned, and generally it will affect those group of taxpayers who will be in a worse of situations. When one tries to address this issue, we are basically proposing three issues, which I will also try to demonstrate by way of an example. Basically, we are of the view that if we would like to deal with the concerns that are presented in the proposals, one has to apply, say that the convergence provisions may apply only to higher income levels. As we know, basically, the elderly and the physically challenged and so on are in a situation where they need to be cared for through medical expenses and the payments that they make. The other issue is saying that maybe one might have to say the current legislations apply only to lower income and not affect the aged and physically challenged. The alternative that one might have to present in order to address this situation is maybe to increase the tax credits, they may be increased in two ways. One might increase the amount itself, or increase the percentage that is being used, as opposed from basically maybe 33.3, one might also move it to say 40 or even more than that. I tried to demonstrate this example of an elderly by the name of Womudau, 6 years old, married to Womuope. They are all saying far in Limpopo. And for 2014-15 tax year, Womudau contributed for him and his wife $2,500 per month to a medical scheme. And of course, in addition to that, had $25,000 qualifying expenses due to his wife's chronic condition. And if we take the information as we have it from the 2012-18 tax year and try to demonstrate this example, we'll realize that the amount that will be have that the person will have or ultimately have as demonstrated by the example is 80,321. However, in this practical example, if we were to increase the amount, basically it's not only for the sake of increasing the amount. What happens is that it is increased as a result of need, because of the conditions on which these people are. I'm fortunately approaching that level in terms of age. So you would see that if we can increase that to 55,000 and apply the 55,000, then there will be a 19,450. And if we move that to 40% marginal rate, it will of course increase. And what we are trying to say here is that if we increase it, Womudau would have a potential tax saving of 19,222,000. So we feel it is better when we implement this one to give them the advantage which they so need in order to be able to live. Thank you on this issue. The other issue that I want to address is basically a concern here with regard to Clause 22, employer-related insurance policy. We are concerned that the changes do not cover cases where there is a loss due to maybe death, disability, or severe illness property. We are also saying that employees that are employed like everyone else need also a life cover, the same as that for against accident at work. When going through the proposals, we are also concerned of the definition of this civil wealth solely, which we feel that is not clear, and we are just urging, although maybe SAS would have already considered that in order to address these issues, once the Act is promulgated, let there be an interpretation note which will try to clarify all these issues so that they can be easy of compliance. My colleague will continue.
On the retirement exemption, there is a move to now allow the unutilized contributions as a deduction against the annuity, and that is welcomed. What we do think, however, is that consideration should be given to allow the tax-exempt portion to be spread over the annuity rather than to guide people to take the lump sum in order to benefit from the tax-exempt portion. So the numbers would remain the same of the tax-exempt portion, but one would then have the ability to choose between using the tax-exempt portion as part of your lump sum or using the tax-exempt portion against the annuity. The whole change to the real estate investment trust is something that might have with it some unintended consequences by a discouragement of savings. At present, through the use of the property loan stock, natural persons can make use of the interest exemption. There has been a move over the last 2 years or so to look to cut away that interest exemption, whereas in truth we believe that this should in fact be expanded to encourage more savings in a country which has very limited savings culture. Here we have people who can invest in something other than a bank investment backed by a property. And now, at present, they have interest exemption relief that comes through. With this change, they won't, and they'll be in a worse-off position. I don't think that that's what we really need when we are looking at encouraging savings. Now, over the last 2 years or 3 years before this committee and in Parliament in the budget speech, the issue of the property developer and their plight due to the cash flow and the need to rent out properties for a temporary basis was tabled. Here we're having a relief for VAT for political parties. And we just want to make sure that there's equal treatment before the law. Qui custodes custodiae, who will guard the guards themselves? You as the custodian of things must ensure there's equal treatment and that you do not benefit yourself as representative of political parties over and above the interests of others. So we know now there will be a change in the law to take the membership income of political parties outside of the VAT net, but that will only apply from a date in the future. Now, just as those property developers were audited, and I personally know of at least 5 clients who had audits and assessments raised on them, quite correctly as the law then stood, so too there's an expectation of the public, equal treatment before the law, that in the period prior to this amendment, there will be equal application of the law. The provisional tax penalties for taxpayers with a taxable income over 1 million rand, brought about some time back, was predicated on the need of SARB to consider before actually raising an assessment. The fact that their computer programmers were not able to put an intervening step for consideration should not be a reason for this House to change the law simply because they can't administer the law set by this House. When in fact, if one is going to look at the issue of penalties for provisional taxpayers, I would even go further to say that that benchmark of 1 million is too low. For taxpayers to reach a million is quite easy, even if they do not have sophisticated businesses. Maybe a secondary test would be turnover over 30 million rand, as covered by the VAT Act, where they then must comply on a monthly basis for the rendition of VAT returns. That might be a better test to see a separation as to where it would be. In the third alternative, one would look to say that million rand needs to be amended on an annual basis in the same way as the Commissioner amends the basic amount on an annual basis by an 8% escalation, far greater than the growth in the economy, one might just say. But here too, there should be a similarly linked escalation on an annual basis without requiring annual amendments to keep the two in parallel. Otherwise, more and more people are being put into a more onerous level of provisional tax calculation than they ought. The small business doesn't have big lobby groups. It is important if we want to create jobs. As was indicated by the prior presentation, we need to rather look to expand this definition and bring more into the spirit of that small business corporation. The 14 million rand that's there at present should be increased to either 25 or 30 million, once again tying it back to the VAT Act, for a much larger organization that's got monthly VAT returns. But one needs to have that level of expansion. I think that this is some direction that would need to come from this committee to the drafters. Now,
just a word of question. We, as I communicated with your office, our focus for today is on the taxation amendment bill. So taxation laws amendment bill. We're still going to consider at an appropriate time that the tax administration bill. So I will just advise you to spend more time on so as to enrich the purpose of this meeting.
Thank you, Chair. We have covered the issues on this current bill that we were to address. If one can have the indulgence that you gave the others on dealing with some aspects of the registration of taxpayers that seem to slip into the first presentation to quite a large extent, if we could have that as our last point, that would be appreciated.
No, that's fine. I was just warning you that I don't miss the key points just because of what you have prepared.
Yeah, that's fine. We covered what we needed to cover on that.
Because we still have to bring an invitation to come and make presentation on this specific matter.
So thank you for that. Just the last point then, on the amendment with regard to the registration of taxpayers. The only concern that we really wish to highlight is once again on the issue of equal treatment. A lot of the people that there is some concern about who don't fall within the SICA, URBA banners are people who used to work at the South African Revenue Services who've now left and gone into commerce and industry. There's now a concern about their level of qualification, their level of advice, and they need to be regulated. My question is, what was the case the day before they went into commerce and industry whilst working at SARS? Surely they too needed to have a regulated format and framework, the same as the person on the other side of the table, to ensure that the taxpayer is treated properly by somebody who understands the law and is implementing it correctly, in the same way as the taxpayer needs protection from their advisor, equal treatment before the law. The same too, one might even dare expand the position further to say that National Treasury and this auspicious committee are making inputs on taxation. Do they not need some grounding and training in tax to be able to do that? One must be careful as to where one is pointing and how one is pointing. If the idea is protection at a commercial level from one's advisor is one thing, but the people themselves need protection from SARS and poor drafting at times in the law. Thank you for that as our submission, and we're willing to answer questions.
Thank you very much, just the time. We will now accord the members a quick opportunity to pose clarification question. That will assist us, of course, to take forward this process on the Taxation Law Amendment Bill. I will advise members just to make sure that we don't lose focus. Thank you very much. Any end, members? Clarification question or presentation? Honourable Koronov, Honourable Petra?
Thank you, Chairperson. Just on the change, I think it's clause 22, the change of the tax invoice. That's the very first time that I do have people coming here and say, you know, please change the act and make it more difficult. You see, the problem is, I know we will assist your offices, you know, in quite a dramatic way. But, you know, for the smaller person, you know, who struggles with that every day, must do everything himself, you know, it's a burden already. Why do you want that? Is it to make your work easier, or is it really to, is it not a huge burden on the small proprietor of a VAT-paying small company?
Honorable Lomthetho, followed by Honorable Harris.
Mr. Chair, if I would ask the last presenter to summarize exactly if you were to ask to summarize, is he believing that we are not doing enough, or we don't know what we are doing here? I don't really understand him. The issue of equal in every month, the equal treatment, where is he basing that?
I'd like you to speak a little bit more about the tax treatment of preference shares, your first slide. I understand that you've identified one particular issue related to BEE transactions, but
I understand that the changes for preference shares might apply more broadly to banks as well. If you could give us a little bit more detail on that. And then the last presentation suggested that for small business, a better threshold would be 25 million. You didn't actually tell us what you think, where you think it should be. Would you think 25 is correct, is accurate, or is rather appropriate, or where would you set the threshold? And then to continue on my colleague's question about the creation of tax invoices, I don't really understand why you're concerned about this. I mean, surely if we make it far easier for tax invoices to be corrected, that sounds like a win-win to me. I mean, I would imagine it's your job to advise your clients and help your clients with their submissions, but if there is a mistake and the corrections apply broadly and are available broadly, then I think it benefits everyone. I don't really see the downside of what you're highlighting. And then tax practitioners, just this relief for political parties. I'd like to understand it a bit better. Does it apply to membership income and donations, or just to membership income? And then what about other income? I mean, I don't actually know what our income sources are like, but I would imagine for our particular party, we probably make a considerable, probably our main item is from donations, and I would imagine we make quite a lot from MPs' constituency allowances. Are those also be exempt? What exactly is the proposal on the table? Thank you.
All right, thank you very much. I will allow the first of Honorable Ross. Let's conclude on this.
Yes, thank you, Chair. My other points were taken, but just a quick comment regarding the Real Estate Investment Trust. I think that's a very important issue to promote savings, and I think it's an important thing that we should note, and also to note that with the Presidential Infrastructure Coordinating Committee doing, you know, in terms of investment needed on the bigger scale, if there could be some tax incentives and you know, proposals to ensure that people invest in this type of investment to make it more attractive, it could be a huge benefit for the country. Thank you.
Okay, I'll allow the first presenter to take questions that are relevant to the presentation, and the second presenter will follow.
First of all, with regard to tax invoices, I'm not proposing that we want to make it more difficult to remedy the current issues of issuing proper documentation. My concern is that the documentation is core to investigation, to fraud, to testing of transactions and supporting transactions. Now, that input deduction that a person claims is essentially a credit of pulling it back from the fiscus. So that should be no different than a certificate. And that's why the bar has been set so high to start off with as to what should be on that document to start off with. Because without all the relevant requirements to it, such as both parties, that numbers and that for an invoice greater than 3,000, the risk of the fiscus is there. So currently, if we had to implement as it stands, I could quite literally write out an invoice or something that pretends to be an invoice on a napkin, and now I can go issue a separate document at some other point without even being able to reference to a napkin because it doesn't even have an invoice number on it to correct. I mean, that's just absurd. There has to be a starting point where we say that I issued what law prescribes as being a tax invoice. My obligation as a vendor should never be taken away from my obligation to issue a proper tax invoice. I'm registered for VAT. I have to charge VAT. For that, I know what my VAT number is. I know what my address is. I know this is a tax invoice depicting a supply. That should always be there. What is not on there is maybe I've got your address wrong, or I've got your VAT number missing, or the description of the goods on there is maybe not correct. That you should fix, and that's what we want. But we don't want you to go and be able to fix a flawed starting point of where you fail to issue a tax invoice as prescribed. Because quite literally, we're now saying that Section 21 should override Section 20's basic prescriptive obligations for you to issue a tax invoice for every supply. That's what it basically says. Now we're going to end up with multiple documents for the same supply, and if we don't even have the basics of, let's say, saying this is a tax invoice, if this is a relevant document for tax for VAT purposes with an invoice number on it, I can't even issue a debit note or credit note to say, I revert to this, because how do I revert it? So from an audit point as well, from SARS and the risk to the fiscus, is it will be an opportunity for fraud and for people to take advantage of this once again. And all that's going to happen is we're going to be reactive, and then the burden is going to be shifted right on again. So what we're trying to say is that we really want these changes to allow you to use a debit or credit note function to correct a flawed invoice. But that invoice to start off with must be a tax invoice at starting point. Without that fundamental starting point, we shouldn't be able to remedy it somewhere else along the line. And I hope that, that addresses your concern. And it's not to make my life easier or someone or business's life difficult. What it is it basically is there to ensure that the evidentiary element that is attached to for my claim for an input tax, recognition of the supply that I've made, trigger for that fact, SARS ability to audit it, all of these things have to be there in place. Otherwise the risk of, to the fiscus, and of course the reactive effect of that risk to fiscus will just end up back where we were in the starting point of while we had to amend Section 20 to add on additional provisions to the tax invoice. So we're just going to end up in a repetitive situation here. The second issue regarding to equity shares, in our review, because our constituency is caters greatly for the small to medium-sized business, so what we did is we reviewed this. The problem is we can't fully appreciate how these amendments are going to affect business and transactions because we don't have the crystal ball or the ability to really see how it practically could affect it until we're in the thick of it. Well, what we did is we tried to apply it to the knowledge we have currently of the type of transactions, typically DE type transactions where we have redeemable preference shares underlying to them, and we identified there that it definitely will capture them, and basically it would cause trouble for current BEE transactions with wording that currently exists in the draft amendment. Our suggestion is not to limit the intention of the law, because we fully agree with the intention of what we're trying to achieve here. We just believe that the net is a little bit too wide, and we haven't really regarded every circumstance to basically override the underlying purpose of the transaction was a legitimate purpose. Because we're automatically saying that if it has certain indications to it, we should treat it X. Regardless of the purpose of whether it was to evade taxes, whether it was to facilitate a BE transaction, we ignore that because it has one or two of the indicators of that this is a transaction that should be treated this way. And we're just concerned with the wide net, and all honesty, we have not considered all the impacts, such as for the banks in this regard as well. Because, again, we've only had limited time to explore this. This is something new to us as well. It's not yet in practice. So fully appreciating even what the effects would be is quite difficult at this point in time. And then with regards to the threshold being proposed on of 25 million, I would say it's difficult for us to propose a threshold. Now, I don't want to counter my colleagues in it, but I feel that if we had to deal with that specific issue, our fundamental problem is not the threshold. It's who we include to participate. A previous submission I made to this very committee is that the Small Business Corporation is so restrictive in terms of personal services that it restricts that quite literally if you engage in services, you're not a small business and you can't get the incentives to help grow and develop and start a new business. You have to quite literally be in retail, manufacturing or similar type businesses to take advantage of the concession. And if you look at worldwide, the largest portion of growth will come from new and emerging businesses, mainly in the service sector. So our fundamental problem is not the threshold, it is who we include. And there have been recent court cases, in fact, where it's been challenged as to what extent a personal service should be included to that. My recommendation to you would be we should be reconsidering what is a personal service and to what extent we want to make this available to small and medium businesses. Once we've got a more inclusive range of businesses that could be included there, then it would be worthwhile for us to consider thresholds. Because once again, that threshold would be quite different for a service type business than it would be to a manufacturing or retail business. Because a retailer, your turnover would be far greater but smaller margins, where in service you would have greater margins, smaller turnover. It's quite a different structure to it. Thank you.
We will have a follow-up what you call session after they have responded to the initial questions. Yeah. Just note your question on the road together.
All right. Thank you, Chair. With regards to the issue of the regularization of tax practitioners,
the main thrust of my comment is that it should apply equally to SARS officials as well as to officials in private practice. We are both involved in tax practitioners on one side of the table, the other. We should all have the same level of ethical training and disciplinary action against us for our actions or inactions. With regard to the small business threshold levels, I would suggest that either the amount be escalated on an annual basis, or in the alternative, it be linked to the threshold of the monthly rendition of a VAT return, being the 30 million rand level, because at that stage, it's difficult to argue that you are small, you are a more complex entity. And so that would be the sort of point that I would link it to. With regard to the VAT relief, the VAT relief for political parties will cover all of their receipts and accruals, being it membership, donations, and other. The primary point, however, is not as to what happened in the future. It's what had happened in the past. And that if one is making, as parliamentarians, a change in the law to exclude yourself from something that you were in before, the very need to make that exclusion, one must make sure that that law as it stood then was applied to you, or that you take the necessary steps to ensure your compliance with. Because it's all very well to sit and talk about all the people who did or didn't, but here we know there's a law that did apply. We must make sure that it is applied equally. Thank you, Chair.
All right, follow up. Another question.
Thank you, Chair. You seem to be having a serious concern regarding your constituency, which is the small medium enterprises, towards the definition of equity share, the way you are saying it's limiting. And but what I want to find out exactly, when your constituency writes what do you call it, an association of something articles, isn't that in that document where you define, according to the Companies Act, the shares, the allocation? Now, if then that is being defined, are you saying to us that definition which you do at that point in time, it will contradict what the Treasury is saying to date? If so, what are those consequences are you referring to? Thank you, Chair.
Can we have a response to that?
I think to clarify, the previous Companies Act had definition with regards to equity share, where the new Companies Act does not have a clear definition of equity share. In fact, the whole principle of what is a share is changed with the new Companies Act, because there's certain instruments that is no longer recognized as such as the ventures is recognized as a debt rather than equity structure. In doing this, you are correct in saying this, that the company defines essentially its share structure in terms of its memorandum of incorporation that it drafts and how it structures things. The problem is not necessarily the definition of the Companies Act. It's how we implement the new Companies Act together with the provisions that are applied here. When we're looking at implementing the structure of the BEE transaction, there's often underlying complex structures to facilitate the transaction. And with that, typically there would be, and in cases we've looked at, there would be redeemable preference shares that specify that there is a specific redemption period, and there would be fixed dividend rate for the BEE partner. Now, if we had applied those facts to the proposed amendment, in terms of the Section 45 provisions that would be there, it basically would require that that there would be a degrouping because of that structure. Now, it has got consequences, because a party might not want to be participating in that type of transaction or degrouping, but maybe you've already entered into this transaction to start off with regards to the BEE structures that you've implemented. Now, the tax law changes, you don't really have an out when you, unless you quite literally go back and change the structure of redeemable preference share. you have to go back and change the fundamental structure of that you started the BEE transaction with in the first place in order to avoid the consequences of the tax essentially would kick in, the tax law would kick in. And that's our concern, is that perhaps here is the next wide, but perhaps even here what one could do is perhaps have a grandfather period where it allows for you to make an election to whether you want to participate into a degrouping structure or not. But leaving the current, you leave no option. It's just kind of forcing the hand. And the foresight wasn't there because we didn't expect legislation like this and this kind of consequence when those BEE transactions were formulated in the first place. So perhaps the transitional processes could be considered.
By a thank you. Say by and by for your responses and presentation. We are now going to move to our next presenter. The first name is Saika, which will be led, or the person who will be presenting to us will be Mr. Smith. And from there we'll have a MIPCO represented by Mr. Fori. Then thereafter we'll then take discussion. Are we ready?
We're ready, thank you.
Thank you very much. No, don't be intimidated by these people are making movements which are not, authorized. So don't be intimidated by that. Proceed with the presentation.
No, thank you, Chair. I was also a lecturer in my previous life, so I understand the movement in classes. We would like to thank you for this opportunity to address you. My name is Pete Nell. I'm from the public director from SAICA, ITACS. Mr. Smith is one of our committee members that will be assisting me today. We basically have a number of issues that we would like to deal with. Just touch on the respective affected dates of legislation. Again, also deal with the medical expenses and just get our take on that. Some fringe benefit issues, the employer-provided motor vehicle. Then just make one point about the debt reduction for less than full consideration, the current amendments that are being brought into legislation, fair value market-to-market adjustments.
Sorry, Mr. Nam. The presentation is in the maybe I should peg it. So let's focus on that. For those who don't have sharp
We then want to just cover one of the international tax issues and then end off with some sundry and other issues that we have. With respect to the respective effective dates, the point I think has been made well enough earlier, so I would really just point out that there are a number of issues where taxpayers are finding themselves in a bit of a problem if the legislation is signed and having done transactions that are now, the legislation now changes effectively from the 1st of April. So I'm just going to give one example. We list all of those examples on the screen. But the last one, dividends declared by a listed company. The rules with regard to the declaration of dividends and the subject of that to the dividends tax have changed as additional requirements. It removed the word payable. It means that listed companies that already declared dividends and maybe didn't have sufficient SEC credits to set off the dividends tax liability will find them in contravention of the law if the law is signed, but they've acted on the old law. And this is just the point we really want to make, that where dates or effective dates are being backdated, taxpayers find them in a difficult position that they cannot generally deal with.
I want to move on to medical tactical credits, and we started on this process now a few years ago, and in principle we're not against the medical credits, it's just some of the issues coming from it and perhaps the legal at the moment. Now, actually everybody is probably aware of my personal experience in the cost of medical keeps increasing in South Africa, and we're concerned about the actual tax benefit that you potentially can get from it. Now, if you look at the level there, especially taxpayers without a disability or disabled family member younger than 65, potentially get very little tax benefit for out-of-pocket medical costs. I just did a quick calculation earlier on. If we look at the criteria, the 25% level of tax credit together with that threshold of 7.5%, if you think of an example, somebody having a taxable income of 500,000 rand, being 64 years old at the year end, they will just get a tax credit for the tax cost. Let's say they had out-of-pocket expenditure 50,000 in a year, that medical cost 50,000, 500,000 taxable income. Their tax credit that they will get will just be about 3,000 rand, which is not a lot. You compare that to a taxpayer at 65, same scenario, 500,000 taxable income, 50,000 out-of-pocket expenditure, being now the 33% level, and without the 7.5% threshold, they will get nearly 17,000. So, our point here is, we should perhaps look at the level there, and especially on the taxpayers below 65, without a disability, they are not getting a lot of benefit from a tax point of view, from a credit, and especially to a larger extent, would have unexpected medical costs and expenditure. Moving on to some of the smaller points there on the slide, you'll notice there that taxpayers, there's a certainty where taxpayers turn 65 in a year, there's certain views on it, about which rules will apply for it, where to be apportionment, etc. Another secondary issue there is the so-called superannuity, ill health or infirmity. Now, in terms of the rules, we had until about 2 years ago. If somebody retired or stopped working for medical reasons, let's say retired somebody at 55 or 60, there were no fringe benefits if the employer continued their medical aid contributions and they had that benefit. That has been taken away last year, and they in essence will now have a taxable fringe benefit, but because of the fact that they are younger than 65, they are under the more restrictive tax rules as far as the credits go, and therefore they will be in a weird position from a tax point of view. Now, the two categories, the super and youth, somebody taking early retirement, but it's also the category somebody has to stop working due to medical reasons. Especially in that category, we're concerned about the additional tax burden because of the fact that it's now fringe benefit and they don't get the same benefits as a taxpayer older than 65. And lastly, just the payroll systems. This could have a significant impact on payroll systems, and we're just urging the quick and timely completion of this legislation to enable payroll companies to be able to finalize this system before the implementation. Moving on to the so-called fringe benefits, and one or two points about motor vehicle. Now, we have to commit and start the National Treasury on this. We, in principle, in favor of the amendment which linked to the motor vehicle fringe benefits, which we debated in this room 2 years ago, where it's now linked to the minimum of the actual cost or the 3.5%. It's just the definition of the operating lease, because that actual cost is where a company doesn't actually buy a vehicle, they go and rent it from a rental company. But the definition that's now being inserted for this operating lease is open for interpretation in the sense that it might also be available to the public for a rental of less than 1 month. Which in some cases, employers sign these long-term type operating leases, which in our mind are still operating leases in the sense that the maintenance and the loss of destruction is still the rental company. But you cannot see this operating lease in terms of this, and our interpretation is the risk that it will be seen as neither operating lease but not really a finance lease, therefore you will not get this benefit. Therefore, we would rather propose that a definition as being used in the VAT Act for installment credit agreement and finance lease definition, rather, which is a definition which in our mind works better for this specific purpose being looked at.
Jen, I want to deal with the debt reductions for less than full consideration of amendments to the legislation, and I must say that certainly is a bit easier to work with than complex legislation we had previously that was all over the Act. But we want to make the first point regarding a link to the capital gains, the schedule that we've already had reference to. In principle, if one acquires an asset on credit and you don't pay the full amount of the credit back, you gain from that. If you don't have to, you're relieved in some sense from not paying that back. So you should pay tax on that from a capital gain point of view, you've gained from that. But the debt reduction does is it links the capital gain or the tax consequence of these reductions to the asset. And if an underlying asset qualified for a tax allowance or was trading stock, it would then also treat either some recoupment or the reduction in the debt. we are concerned that the leak wasn't put through to the H schedule, where paragraph 20 of the H schedule, to be technical, requires similarly where the debt is reduced, that the cost must be reduced. So we find that it may become difficult or impractical to calculate the actual capital gains or the recoupments in this regard. And our suggestion or our submission merely requests that this be considered to make certain that link is there. The new debt reduction is covered in section 19 of the Income Tax, the new section 19 of the Income Tax Act. There were certain links to financial instruments. Don't want to bore you with the technicalities or technical details of that, but again, it's similar to trading stock. We feel that the interaction between the treatment of your gain or loss when you repay your financial instrument and the reduction that's similar link to the debt is not well addressed in the legislation. And then we make a proposal in bringing in the new section 19. The draft legislation deletes all of the paragraphs and sections in the Act that dealt with debts and the waiver of debt and liabilities by taxpayers. Under the old capital gains regime, if I say old, the one that used to be replaced in the paragraph 12.5, it provided for group relief. So if a debt was waived or reduced in a group structure, no capital gain or loss arose. We have a similar principle now in dividends or moving of cash between companies in the group. To meet the group requirement, there will be no capital gain that arises from that. It's not part of Section 19, and we feel that it should be part, and therefore our submission talks to that and request that be considered, that again, a group relief should be built into the debt reduction for less than consideration.
If we move on to the next point there, the fair value and market adjustments, especially aimed at financial institutions. Now, we know Tracy has consulted widely with specific sectors in this regard. Through our membership base, however, we have sourced the following comments that we want to make to this committee today. I mean, this again is complex legislation, and we're again concerned about the implementation as soon as the other assessment starting on or after 1 January 2013. And we felt, especially in the light of what we are going to tax is potential gains which have not realized yet. Now, there is a belief in some commentators that this system of accounting, because you bring accounting rules down to tax, had an impact on the worldwide global financial crisis way back 2008, and I feel that investigations is still ongoing in Europe and Australia regarding that impact. Should we really be bringing this into our tax legislation yet? In principle, it's not going to be opposed yet, but shouldn't we wait a bit and investigate further? Also, we're linking it now to accounting rules tax, and which is not always a sound stable base. When changes occurs, and now internationally there's already some countries proposing changes to this exact interest rules here, and will that confusion now automatically affect tax legislation, and will we have regular changes as soon as the accounting environment changes their rules, because we're linking now tax to accounting. Just one of the smaller points there, they talk a lot about legislation by hedge and hedging, and we feel that probably a wider or more clearer definition in the Tax Act is needed. And lastly, this is initially just aimed now at very selected groups, like for example the banking industry, listed companies, and although there might be some other taxpayers who have also got the same type of financial instruments to a greater extent. So the proposal could potentially be to make it elective for these type of taxpayers subject to a certain criteria to also include them in this proposal, and as they also extensively deal with these type of financial instruments.
The comments that we have on international tax, definition of to the definition of resident for tax purposes. Maybe if I could just give just some background to what effectively is happening or proposed to happen. Currently, a company would be deemed to be a resident of South Africa that has its place of effective management in South Africa. That does lead to some anomalies, and we grateful for the proposal to amend that, to clarify the legislation there. What the proposal requires, it introduces four tests in this regard with regard to effective management. The first one is that the company must be currently incorporated, so it must not have originated in South Africa. The second one is that effective management must be in South Africa, which under the old law would have made it a South African resident. The third one, that must have a foreign business establishment. So it must operate in the country and have activities in the country other than South Africa. And then the last one, and this is the one that concerns us, it must pay tax in that foreign country at a rate that is at least effective to 75% of South African tax rate. Now, let's not do numbers here. What our submission is best explained by an example. Let's say we've got a company in Namibia that would meet that requirement. Foreign registered in Namibia, effectively managed from South Africa, so South African residents, maybe Cape Town, manages a company. They've got a permanent establishment, they've got activities in Namibia. They now pay tax at the required rate. Namibia doesn't tax capital gains. So they sold a capital asset, and that's quite a huge, and this is the way in which we calculate it. It's quite a huge capital gain. They would in that year lose their resident status because they don't meet all four of those requirements. And we believe that your definition of tax residence should not be driven by tax implications. That's why that submission was made. The rollover provisions have been extended quite significantly to also include cross-border asset or share transactions, and again, we welcome the proposals in this regard. There are certain anomalies where there are certain attentions that are communicated to us in the explanatory memorandum. The one that we covered in our example is that you must hold all the shares in the company, whereas it seems that the requirement really must be that it must form part of a group of companies to qualify for the role of relief. And really in our submission, we point out these and just ask for clarification or whether the law didn't affect what the intention was. That's our proposal, and that's the point. Sundry issues.
Yes, the first point is regarding VAT. Now, in the budget speech earlier the year by the Minister of Finance, it was mentioned that they intend to address the issue about the compulsory VAT registration and the 21 days which you got to register after you've met the criteria and stop charging VAT, which is a serious problem in business out there at the moment because of the fact that due to the onerous process from SARS side to address their risk, which we understand, it takes a lot longer to obtain a VAT number. Now, unfortunately, that didn't end up in the legislation, and it is a serious concern for business out there. And as some of you might be aware, last year one of the issues raised by when they did a survey about international companies doing business in Africa was one of the difficult things of doing business in Africa is obtaining a VAT number. And it sounds ridiculous, but due to the risk procedures, the fraud, which solves at the counter from their side, is not as easy a process as that. That's why probably the longest period is needed in the 21 days. And we will welcome the suggestion by the Minister in the budget speech, but we couldn't find that proposal in the final legislation. So we just raise that point as we do it to be very important.
Chair, you'll notice that the last ones are actually just what we believe are omissions from that. We have dealt with the provisional tax, and as you quite rightly pointed out, that's not part of the tax Amendments Act, it's part of the Tax Administration Act, but if I could just make this point that with the Tax Administration Act, they're not part of the process of having a speedy signature and finalisation of the Act. Taxpayers are left in a quandary. There are amendments that address really, and it was made in our submission to the Minister's budget speech, that really needed urgent addressing. It was addressed, unfortunately, not in the Tax Administration Laws Act, but in the Tax Administration Act. So one will really would hope that be signed so that by then February, if we make our next provisional tax payments, those amendments were affected in that. And with regard to the regulation of tax practitioners, I believe that we will address that in the when we deal with the Tax Administration Act. I'll skip that. Lastly, just some other final points. The final dividend cycle and the secondary tax on company credits that have to be transferred into the new cycle. It is interesting to note that there are many commentators that have differing views here about the actual section 65 capital B that gives us this DDCC credit that the current legislation and the Tax Administration Amendment Bill makes amendments similarly to the dividend tax, which again be backdated. I talked to our point of backdating of legislation or making legislation effective while transactions have happened thereafter. And it seems that out in the market there still is uncertainty regarding the actual creation of the ETC credits, and we address that in our submission. Corporate rules, we don't want to say much about it, we just want to point out that we've covered that quite significantly in our submission. One of the earlier parties has addressed interest in current and acquisition transactions.
Thank you very much. While you are getting these points, but be aware that you have a CDS, you are
30 minutes. Okay. We're done, thank you. So we made a standalone submission on residential valuation of fringe benefits, which we have submitted and which is part of our submission. Thank you for your time, Jim.
Let's just try to keep the timing or the relevant. The tax administration aspects will be dealt with an appropriate basis because this is what is taking time, you know. I'm going to call our next presentation. So we are able then to go for the last round of discussion. The next presentation, as indicated earlier on, will be done by Mr. Fori on behalf of Motor Industry Bargaining Council.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Committee, for affording us the opportunity. Essentially, the presentation that I'll be giving deals around the specific issues that we are encountering within motor industry, bargaining council, and bargaining and council environment as a whole, pertaining to some income. Well, it's actually one income tax issue and a VAT issue. Pertaining to bargaining councils and income tax, bargaining councils are exempted from income tax in terms of Section 101D3 of the Income Tax Act. I'm not going to read through the definition. The problem was that with the establishment of the old National Industrial Councils Act, there was an omission that the council couldn't hold properties in its own capacity. Now, this shortcoming was overcome by the National Industrial Council for the Motor Industry, which was NICMI, through the establishment of property companies to hold these properties on their behalf, and they were operational properties, properties from which it conducted business, and were not investment properties. With the revision and the work that was done in the Labor Relations Act, bargaining councils are now allowed to own property in their own capacity. And many of the tax companies that's holding these properties are now transferring them into the bargaining council environment. But the problem is that during the old dispensation, when the National Industrial Councils Act was effective, some of these properties were sold, and also now with the transfer from these private companies into MIBCO, dealing with the capital gains tax issue and possible income tax issues. So because these properties were for the sole purpose of conducting a business, it was investment companies, even when those companies were sold, or the properties were sold out of these companies, they were replaced with new properties for the purpose of conducting our business. And obviously the sole beneficiary of this additional funds, this capital gains that was received from the selling of those properties or the transfer of those properties was the Motor Industry Bargain Council or the old National Industrial Council for Motor Industry. It's our respectful request that we look at a way through which we can exempt that capital gains because MIBCO is really not liable for tax, and because of the omission in the previous National Industrial Councils Act, we now have this problem with the capital gains, and the only beneficiary is the bargaining council. So we're looking for a way to reduce that liability or to get rid of that capital gains tax, since it is for the benefit of the motor industry. Then in terms of the VAT amendment that was proposed in the Act previously, the VAT Act omitted the exemption of bargaining councils from that. Now, the new submission or the proposed amendment reads that there's, by addition of paragraph K, the following paragraph, the supply of any goods or service by a bargaining council that is established in terms of Section 27 of the Labor Relations Act 1995 to any of its members to the extent that the consideration of such supply consists of membership contributions. Now, firstly and foremostly, the problem that we're dealing with is that if this gets enacted as it is proposed, we're still dealing with retrospective aspects of what happened in the past, and We would just like some clarification that it was always the intent, from our understanding, that bargaining councils were exempt from that. So we just want to clarify that, that there's no future consequences there. Secondly, it deals specifically with the membership contributions. Now, in terms of the membership contributions, if you look at the purpose of a bargaining council as defined by the Labour Relations Act of 1995, and I'm referring to Section 27, the powers and functions of a bargaining council. The powers and functions of a bargaining council in relation to its register scope includes the following: to conduct collective agreements, to enforce those collective agreements, to prevent and resolve labour disputes, to perform dispute resolution functions referred to in Section 51, the establishment and administer of funds to be used for the resolving disputes, to promote and establish training and education schemes, to establish and administer pension fund, provident fund, medical aid, sick pay, holiday, unemployment and training schemes or funds or any similar schemes or funds for the benefit of one or more of the parties in the bargaining council or their members. And I'm just going to read up to that point. Now, what we want to ask is, in terms of the proposed amendment, we want to have extend that to other revenue streams to the bargaining council. And the primary motivation is that within the MIPCA environment, I believe in the environment of other bargaining councils, you have a pension fund scheme, and the bargaining council acts as a collecting agent for the pension fund scheme. It provides enforcement services for that pension fund scheme. And as a result, there's some recovery of costs that we need to get from the pension fund scheme, and that essentially forms a part of our revenue. And it is requested that this is also exempted from VAT. The real reason for that is that without that recovery of costs from the pension fund, you're going to need to increase your levies. That will have a detrimental effect on the members in the industry, which, if you look at the purpose of a bargaining council, really defines the point. And then lastly, it's also then motivated that VAT exemption, in terms of the property companies that are held by the bargaining council, that it be extended to that level. The reason for this, although these property companies aren't leased out to any private individuals and there's no profit being made, it is essentially just for operational activities and it's intercompany transfers, there might be a point in time when you looked at deemed services rendered or something of that nature which might negatively impact on the council and that liability, which I don't think is the intent. So it is requested that the exemption be extended to these property companies and then also that be done not only prospectively but also retrospectively since the omission was previously there and to deal with the history of it. Chair, that all from my side.
Thank you. Honourable members, this is our turn to pose clarity seeking questions for discussions. Honourable Harris, there's only one hand. Honourable Harris.
For SICA, three questions. The medical expenses, everything I've read up until now talks about how taxpayers over the age of 65 are going to be worse off because they're currently allowed to deduct. They're currently allowed to deduct all of their contributions to the medical scheme and their medical expenses. Now, I understand the principle of changing from a deduction to a credit because it does, I guess, make things more equitable. But now your approach was to talk about how the taxpayers under the age of 65 will also be worse off. So if both of those facts are true, then the only winner here is SOS. Can you just clarify exactly, firstly, not necessarily the point you made, but the point that other people are making, that taxpayers over 65 are worse off too, because if you combine it with the point you made, then everybody is worse off. Secondly, how would you classify someone as a tax resident if you don't think the 75% will work? And then thirdly, I took a look at the minister's speech on the period to obtain a VAT number, and I couldn't find a commitment from him. What exactly did he say would happen, and where should that be in the legislation? Thank you.
Thank you. Can we get some response?
Okay, thanks, Chair. Yes, I'm going to start off with question one and three, then we'll deal with question two next to me. Firstly, on the medical question, thank you very much. Yes, I mean, regarding taxpayers older than 65, they get credit at the level of 33.3%. Now, I agree with commentators saying that you get a low benefit because if they tax you at the maximum marginal tax rate of 40%, their medical expenditure as a deduction would have been worth 40% today. But if you look at the current level, it's roughly a taxpayers with a taxable income of more than 630,000 a year. Given the credit at 33.3%, a lot of taxpayers older than 65 might actually benefit because some of them might be at the 25% or the 18% level. So yes, there's a category which will be off worse, but not necessarily to the same level as the original proposal, which I commented on in this room 2 years ago, where they would be treated also on the 25% level. So I think there was a big improvement to that step, but keeping it at 40% as a policy decision, then a lot of taxpayers will win because all the taxpayers below 630,000, etc., will indeed get that benefit at a 40% level, because that's the only way that nobody will lose, if I can put it like that. So yes, there's a losing category, but our small, our big, mean that's to decide from a policy point of view. As far as taxpayers younger than 65, it's not really that they, it's both an old and new legislation now, is that if you think of the level of medical expenditure and the tax benefit they are getting, if for example there's 500,000 taxable income, 50,000 out-of-pocket expenditure, only a credit of 3,000 rand, is that really sufficient? Now, I believe even in the old legislation, it wasn't sufficient. So it's not like if you compare part by part, that was, it's a new problem that's being created by this amended bill. This historically, again, probably going back to policy decisions, should be given. But through the level and the cost of medical out there, are we helping taxpayers younger than 65 without a disability enough from a tax point of view, if I can put it like that? So that would be our answer to that question. Regarding the third question, where was found this in that detailed document released the budget, the so-called tax proposals, towards the end on page 24, that just said clarification of the data liability for VAT registration, and there it explained in that paragraph the 21 days. Now, where will we fix it? It'll probably be in Section 23 of the VAT Act that we will have to give a bit of relief regarding that 21 days, etc., if we need to be fixing, but it was in that budget in the detailed tax proposal document that was released in the budget speech in February. Thank you, and over to Pete. Page 24 of the budget document on the SARS website, the tax proposals budget 2012 is the document's name.
Thank you. Dealing with the resident definition, are the question with regard to the 75% or the requirement that the tax payable must also enter into the definition of a resident, is that it's basically superfluous. We submit that if the company has a permanent establishment in the foreign country, have the physical presence there, and also have all the requirements located outside of Africa, that it shouldn't be a resident, and that the term effective management in that instance shouldn't bring it back as a resident in South Africa. That's principally our submission then.
Any follow-up? Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much for your presentation and also participating in this. This is a very important process. It is important because it gives us, to divide the constitutional obligation that we have of ensuring public participation on some of these processes. It accords us an opportunity to tap into the expertise, but we must need to take appropriate decisions. So we really appreciate your effort, we really appreciate your presentation. We need the presentation because legislative tax is a critical aspect of an optimal tax system. We are unable to talk of optimal tax. Well, I know implementation is key, but legislation is basic for me. So thanks very much for your contribution. You are really adding value in this big process that we are coupling with turning South Africa into an appropriately developed country. You know, so your contribution is highly valued. Honourable members, thank you also for posing questions, and I think our work continues.
because from here, early educated, we will get a person. Keith, I think you are here. You have listened attentively. We are also waiting for your sound advice. Yeah, we are. if it doesn't sound like that, you're supposed not to be here. All right, thanks very much, Advocate Jenkins, our parliamentary advisor, with whom we know that will come back and give us also some tips on what are the issues that we need to look at, the type of strengthening this process, and maybe an appropriately promulgated act at the end of the day. And I honourable members, on Tuesday, no engagement, formal engagement. Wednesday, we have three pieces of legislation that we must deal with. The first one is, obviously, we'll get an informal briefing from National Treasury. As you know, we still have a lot of laws to do to make sure that our financial markets are properly regulated. We will be dealing with the financial laws, General Amendment B. That will be the briefing. And from there, we will finalize the credit rating services bill, as well as the financial market services bill. So that says we will have enough, I mean, for Wednesday morning. And we are going to start at 9 o'clock, not 9:30. Please, let's make sure that we are all on time. Members and our presenters and our guests, our students, once more, good luck with your studies. The country needs you. Thank you very much. This meeting is officially adjourned.